Your Excellency, Reverend Fathers, dear friends in Christ, as always, it's a special privilege for me to address this conference, which I consider to be one of the most important given in the United States. And I've chosen a topic which I believe is extremely needed today, namely, how to go from defeat to victory. In his great novel, The Brothers Karamazovs, Dostoevsky puts the following words in the mouth of Ivan, one of the characters. The earth is soaked from its crust to its very center with the tears of humanity, unquote. It is hard to express the tragic question of every single human being who is born to raise. Why should we suffer? Deep down, we have such a longing for happiness. We strive for it with every fiber of our being. And so many of us, very many of us, are disappointed, disillusioned. Why is it that life promises so much and then ends in bitterness and despair? Why? Having taught for 37 years in a secular university, that is to say, in the lion's den, I know that one of the greatest difficulties that students and people encounter is, you claim that God exists. You claim that he's good and all-powerful. And I'm going to refute you. Suppose that he's good. How can he stand the horrible suffering that human beings experience throughout their lives? Therefore, he cannot be good. You claim that he's all-powerful. But if he's good, then obviously he should put an end to these meaningless tortures, and he doesn't do it. Conclusion, God does not exist. No serious metaphysician can escape from this dilemma. Can a satisfactory answer be found? The gamut of human suffering is almost illimited. There's no particle of the human body that cannot cause excruciating pains. From his birth to his death, man is exposed to pains and diseases and suffering. As Pascal, the French philosopher of the 17th century, wrote, quotes, a vapor, a drop of water, suffices to kill him. You and I have no guarantee that within an hour from now we'll still be alive. Physical pain is terrible, but I do not believe that it is necessarily the worst of all pains. What about psychological pains? What about the pains of people who are not loved, who are rejected, who are looked down upon, who are considered to be nobody, who do not feel that they deserve to exist because there's absolutely nobody who says to them, I rejoice that you're alive. Rivalry between children and siblings can cause severe pains. There are parents who suffer tortures because they know that their child is rejected by other children. And I'm sorry to say, children can be terribly cruel to other children, particularly if they have some sort of physical deficiency or some sort of physical weakness. The brave new world in which we live does not see any end to the horrors that are taking place. You just need to read the newspaper and you find out that every single day there are millions of people in tears, absolutely shaken by sorrow because they have lost a loved one. And it all seems to be so meaningless. Why? A young child can already harbor bitterness because he's rejected. Just a few days ago, I usually watch French television for about 10 minutes every day. A man cold-bloodedly shot 8 people that were having some sort of city meeting and wounded 19 others. And then he was arrested and said, why did you do that? because he said, I'm a failure. I'm a loser. I have never succeeded in anything that I've tried to do, and I take my revenge on humanity. And then, in some mysterious way, as the police was absent-minded for a moment, he threw himself out of the window and committed suicide. Now, he did not want to, he wanted to commit suicide in any case, but before doing it, he wanted to make sure that he was going to harm other people, a world that has not given him a chance of succeeding. Now, of course, the world in which we live, and I'm speaking particularly of the Western world, the rich world, is a world where the thing that counts is to achieve, to succeed, to make money, to be famous. This is what counts. How you are rated. What have you achieved? You know, sometimes perfect non-entities die, and then the New York Times is going to have a long, long obituary to tell you all the things that they have done in business and how much money they have acquired. And then, of course, there are secret sufferings, sufferings that nobody knows about, and which might be the very worst. When you read the lives of saints, and one of the blessings of my Catholic education was that already when I was a small child, the nuns acquainted me with the lives of saints. And I knew, ultimately, these are my role models. These are the people that I should look up to. And then what do you discover? A saint is canonized, a saint is glorified, and then you read their lives and you find out that there is the cross, the crown of thorn, humiliation, suffering, rejection. A saint is essentially a victor, a conqueror who is placed facing all these difficulties and always manages to give the divine answer, the supernatural answer. From the very beginning of the world, people have raised the question, why should we suffer? And you will notice that again and again, they have tried to find a solution. I found the key. I'm going to eliminate suffering. You know, the promise of the detestable new age is once again we're going to create a universe in which all tears will be dried and everybody will be well off, and then truly life will be worth living. The mistake is to treat suffering and evil as a problem. And I mean by problem an objective difficulty. You have a difficulty and you try to solve it, and once you have found the solution, the problem is solved. And then you turn to another problem. This is typical, for example, of science or mathematics. You have a problem, you don't know how to go to the moon. Now we have solved the problem. We have gone to the moon, and then the next is to say to go to Mars or to Jupiter, so God knows where. It's solved. And you will notice that problems are outside of myself. Buddha, the Buddha, saw suffering as a problem. And it is his claim that actually the problem can be solved. We suffer, he says, because we constantly have cravings and desires that cannot be fulfilled, or we cannot fulfill. There's a famous sentence, if you have 100 loves, you have 100 sorrow. If you have 99 loves, you have 99 sorrows. And it goes down and down and down and down. And then if you have one love, you have one sorrow. And if you have no love, you have no sorrow. Therefore, eliminate desire. Detach yourself totally. All desires should be totally eliminated. And then one very fine day, you will find yourself free from suffering and you enter the nirvana. You take Marxism. Marxism sees suffering as a problem. And what is a problem? Injustice, economic injustice. Some people have too much and other people have too little. Now, in other words, if you introduce a Marxistic system and the state would be the only possessor of wealth and riches and then would distribute it, then you're going to have the paradise for the workers. No, unfortunately, we now know that the paradise for the workers is called Gulag. We know about this now. But I mean, his aim was to create a world in which suffering is illuminated, totally eliminated. There is no more suffering because, no, of course, another mistake, a tragic mistake of Marx is to believe the only type of suffering is poverty. Totally forgetting that the holiest people who have existed, namely the saints, chose poverty. They did not try to make money, they tried to serve others. But this is something that I'm not going to go into. What I would like to say is that suffering is not a problem. It's not something which can be solved in the sense of saying, now look my book, read my book, and you have all the answers and suffering will be eliminated. It is what I call a mystery. Not a supernatural mystery like the Holy Trinity or the presence of Christ in the Eucharist, but a mystery in the sense, number one, that you could never find on this earth a final answer which is of such nature that you say, no, I know it all. I solved it. And number two, because mystery is something in which I myself am personally involved. It is not something outside of myself. You will notice that when we speak about evil, evil is there. Evil are, you know, the Bin Laden, bad enough. You know, evil is outside of myself, and I'm the innocent sheep suffering from evil. And it never occurs to me that I myself am involved in it. And unless I fight evil in myself, my chances of overcoming evil in others is very, very small. Let us turn for a very brief moment to Greek tragedies. Because they're called tragedies, they're all referring to suffering, sometimes terrible suffering. But there are two things that I would like to say very briefly about Greek tragedy. One of them is that it is a punishment for arrogance. You might recall the famous tragedy of Sophocles called Ajax. And now it's almost a quote, but Ajax says at one point, I know that they're gods. I'm not going to ask for their help, because if I succeeded, I would not have the full credit. I want to achieve success on my own, unaided. And the punishment of the god is he's struck by madness. A very good punishment for metaphysical arrogance. There's also a dimension in Greek tragedy of fate. Oedipus kills his father, not knowing that it is his father. He marries his mother, not knowing that she is his mother. And the children and the family is cursed. Now, in other words, the gods at times seem to target a particular individual and lead him to his ruin. In the Old Testament, we reach a much higher level. And it is not surprising because of the ultimate unity between Old and New Testament, the Old constantly pointing to the New. Suffering is a punishment for sin. And what is sin? A revolt against God. This is essentially the essence of sin. Today in our world, number one, the new fashion is that we cannot sin. I heard recently, a few days ago, that a Catholic school in New Rochelle, where I live, that one of the nuns said to the children, one cannot commit a mortal sin. Murder is an exception, but apart from that, you cannot commit a mortal sin. What a comfortable feeling. This is what Catholic kids are taught today. No, sin is to turn against God. Of course, in the Old Testament, the most striking example of suffering is Job. And what is so baffling about Job is that he claims that he's sinless. His friend said, you have sinned, and this is why you're punished. He said, no, I'm innocent, I'm guiltless. And nevertheless, he suffers. And God says to him, oh, dare you question me? This is something that I have permitted. Who are you to challenge me and ask me why? And then, of course, comes the New Testament. And it is my claim that it is in the New Testament, illumined by the infallible teaching of the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church as far as dogmas are concerned. It is my claim that it is in the New Testament, and New Testament alone that we're going to find not an answer to suffering, but a light illuminating suffering and showing that it has a profound meaning. I'm such a sissy that I cannot stand the prick of a needle if it is meaningless. Why? But if you say to me, suffering has a meaning, and thanks to God's grace and to his holy teaching, I discover the meaning of suffering, the whole picture changes radically. Just last week, we relived the condemnation of Christ to death, his atrocious death on Golgotha, leading to the resurrection last Sunday. Now, the very moment that you realize that the Savior of the world, the second person of the Holy Trinity, the Holy One par excellence, chose suffering, excruciating pains, and death in order to save us, you certainly have an inkling of the ultimate link existing between the meaning of suffering as an expression of ultimate love. That is what Christianity offers us. That is the most precious gift that you can imagine, because every single time that you are tortured by the question of, say, why? If I truly understood what God is sending me, you will understand that it is a unique opportunity for love to conquer and to manifest itself. Today, we live in a world which is so de-Christianized, and I don't hesitate to say so, because unfortunately, we know that even priests and nuns are no longer teaching, many of them are no longer teaching the Catholic faith in all its beauty and greatness. There are innumerable such cases, and it must make the angels cry in heaven because they're betraying the particular mission which is confided to them. Now, this is why I discovered through the very many talks that I give, that when you say to people, the secret is a turning to the supernatural, I'm certain that people are going to raise their hand and say, supernatural, what does it mean? They have no idea, or they believe it is some sort of sorcery or something, you know, sort of Harry Potter affair. This is what it is. It is not so. What is the supernatural? Man is a creature. Like every other human being and every other animal and every other thing which is created is a creature. That is to say, a being totally and completely dependent upon God, drawn out of nothingness and sustained in existence by the power of God. But if God ceased to sustain us, all of us in one moment would fall back into nothingness where we belong. Now, this is, let us say, the mark of creatures, total dependence upon God, and each nature, human nature, animal nature, vegetative nature, or an inanimate being, possess a certain endowment, which is their nature. It is the nature of a bird to fly and of a fish to swim. But man is unique among the creatures that we know through experience, because man alone is given the amazing, overwhelming gift of partaking in God's very life. This is the supernatural. Let us make man to our image and likeness. This is not said about animals. And today, this is something which is totally lost sight of when you realize that the prestigious Princeton University appoints a professor trying to convince young people by the thousands that there's no basic difference between man and animals. As a matter of fact, that a healthy animal is much better than an unhealthy human being. You know, this is what we are teaching in our universities. In other words, man who has been knighted by God, and all of a sudden he finds his satisfaction in saying, you know, we are just like animals. There's a very beautiful program on nature, you know, given in New York once a week or so. Sometimes it's beautiful landscapes and animals and so on and so on. But it's usually prefaced by saying, you know, the picture of a chimpanzee and saying, our ancestor. No, there's every now. Suppose that I went to Salt Lake City, I was there yesterday, by the way, and had some time to do some research work about my ancestors. And we'd find out that way back in the Middle Ages, I descend from a French king. Now, my friends, you can be certain that in every talk that I give, I will find a subtle way of letting you know that I'm not one of these vulgar nobody, but that there's still some blue blood in my veins, maybe watered down, but nevertheless some. Well, vanity is not perfect, but it's quite human. Now, I had a student who tried to convince me very arrogantly that we descend from apes. So I told her this sort of imaginary story about my going to Salt Lake City, and I said, no, you claim that your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother jumped from tree to tree in Africa. Now, the day the missing link is found, I will accept it, but I would not brag about it. You know, fantastic news. Look, that's my great-great-grandmother. As a matter of fact, I do not understand why evolutionists do not put a picture of the chimpanzee in their living room with their grandfather and grandmother and so on. And so this is where we descend from. Now, this is just to show you the disaster which has taken place in the Roman Catholic Church because people no longer have any sense of the reality of the supernatural. They believe that human reason can answer all questions. They arrogantly say, let us turn to science. Now today it's not only physical science, it is psychology, it is sociology, it is anthropology, which Edith Stein called science in diapers. Because whether they're truly scientific is something that you can discuss or how scientific they are. Reason flounders every time that it tries to answer the question of suffering. The supernatural is a partaking in God's life. It comes from above, and it cannot be invented by a human being. As a matter of fact, I'm going to make a claim. One of the proofs of the divinity of Christianity is that it could never have entered a man's head. This is something that no human being could have imagined. Other religions can be explained by some sort of human invention. This is something that transcends anything that man can imagine. A God who is infinitely perfect, accepting to take the shape of a slave, to become man, to be incarnated in the womb of a woman, giving thereby to women an extraordinary dignity, to accept suffering and crucifixion and death in order to save sinners. This is divine. And this is going to be the answer given to the question of suffering. Now, thanks to Christ coming down and giving us his grace and the sacraments and the teaching of the Holy Catholic Church, the way is reopened to us. But Christ said, he who wishes to follow my disciple, carry his cross and follow me. Now, all of us are willing to follow Christ to Mount Tabor. Not very many are willing to follow him to Golgotha. If Christianity were just Mount Tabor, you'd be surprised how many good Christians we'll have. But unfortunately, on this earth, we have to carry our cross day after day. And Mount Tabor is going to be in eternity. Now, let us look at the world in which we live. The American world of the 20th and early 21st century. And of course, this includes Western Europe, which is as sick as we are, if not worse. Now, from our very youth, the moment they're about this high, we are taught that what counts in life is success, accomplishment, performance, creativity. These are the goals of human existence, to make it, to make the headlines, so that everybody can know you, to make money, to be powerful, to have success. And everyone says, look, I mean, just imagine that Bill Gates entered this room. Bill Gates. Well, I mean, this is an unhealthy adulation that we have for people who have succeeded. It is Oprah. You know, she's taking as a spiritual director by millions of people. Oprah said, you have a problem and you turn to Oprah. Of course, there are even people who would consider to be a privilege and an honor to shake the hands of our ex-president of the United States. I mean, after all, he was president, he made it. I mean, should we close our eyes to a few little flaws in his character? This is something which is quite secondary. He was the most powerful political figure in the world. Now, success and power and money and achievement are tempting for fallen nature. You know, for example, to be on television is the ideal of good many people, because once you're on television, you are real. You know, I know people who never greeted me, and then one day they saw me on television, and all of, oh, good morning, I saw you on television. I became real because I was on television. And when you realize how many fools are on television, it's not necessarily a compliment to see. No, not only do we want to succeed, we crave for the admiration of other people. To be praised, to be adulated, to be flattered, to be told that we're extraordinary, there's no one like us, and so on and so on. And we want to please ourselves. Look what I have accomplished. We could call it the acquired narcissistic syndrome, that all of a sudden you make of yourself the center of the universe because you believe that you are so extraordinarily great and powerful. You have money, you have achievement, maybe you're very good looking and the rest of it. You have fulfilled yourself. Today, the aim of human life is self-fulfillment, and people constantly take the pulse, am I fulfilled? And if they find that they're not fulfilled, of course, the easy solution is to say, it's because my husband, I look for another one. Or it's because I have too many children, so, you know, I can possibly drown them or something of the sort. I mean, to get rid of it, to get fulfilled. No, what I would like to do, that most of us do not make it. Most of us are not millionaires. Most of us are not on television. Most of us are not powerful. Most of us will never become president of the United States, and so on and so on. And then what happens? That we suffer. What have I achieved in life? I haven't got any money. Why should he succeed and I don't? And then you have the green eye of envy. You'll be amazed how many sufferings that we face are self-made sufferings. Because we are jealous, because we are envious, because we are self-centered, because we are proud. You know, I know people that are crushed if they write a book and find no publisher. You know, this is such an offense, the dignity of the intellect. Now, of course, you know, there are plenty of books that are not published, and it might be a blessing. I personally believe too many books are published. And suppose that lots of them were burnt, it might be a blessing for humanity. Why should every stupidity be published? And of course, the more stupid, the greater chance of success in the world in which we live. Many people create their own sufferings, very much as my medical doctor, a dear friend of mine, said, you'll be amazed how many sicknesses are self-caused. You eat too much, or you eat too little, or you exercise too much, you exercise too little, you become obese, you have this problem and that problem. You create them. Just imagine the millions of people who die of cancer because they have smoked. And you say to them, don't smoke. I know, this is something that I have to do. Suppose that you say, well, of course, you're going to have cirrhosis of the liver because you drink too much. Well, drinking, I mean, my life would be meaningless if I didn't drink. You create these sufferings. No, St. Paul says, Christ does not try us beyond our strength. And I always say to myself, dear St. Paul, you're mistaken there. You know, because every single time I face a real problem or difficulty, he said, that's too much for me. But What I slowly discover with age is that he sends me a cross of, let us say, 10 pounds. I'm certain to add another 5. And then afterwards I say, it's too heavy for me, but I've added 5 more pounds. And for the 5 pounds that you add, you do not get an ounce of grace. There God is ruthless. I'm going to give you grace for real crosses. I'm not going to give you any grace for imaginary self-made crosses. None. And then we are crushed by it for the very plain reason that it is too heavy. And it is obviously too heavy. Supernaturally speaking, we should not care at all what other people say about us. He's bright, he's intelligent, he's a success, he's fantastic, he's witty, and so on and so on. We should only ask ourselves, is God pleased with me? And if you have reason to assume that it is so, forget about what other people say about you. It should leave you totally different, because what people say is a flatus vocis. It is just a voice disappearing into thin air. And you will notice that one day they're going to say one thing, and another day they will say another thing. There are people who rate you much too high, and there are people who not, and who cares? What difference does it mean? As long as I can say, my God is pleased with me because I'm trying to be a faithful servant. Success is dangerous for us, enormously dangerous. My beloved Plato, and if you read Plato's Ethics, you're amazed at the depth and beauty of the insights that he had 24 centuries ago. Plato says in the Laws, quote, victory, has been and always be suicidal to the victors, unquote. Shortly before his death, my husband was already very, very sick, said to me, you know, I'm too old and sick to write another book. But if God gave me a few years to live, I will write a new book. Hitler won the war. How shocking a title. He's been defeated, crushed completely. Germany was destroyed in 1945. But he has conquered us because the brutality, the immorality, euthanasia, the murder of people that are crippled and so on, this is something that we now accept and which are legalized. It's perfectly all right. You don't need to have a bad conscience. The law permits it. Abortion is legal. And it's one of the greatest scandals in the history of humanity. You can murder peacefully, nobody's, provided that you do so 5 minutes before the baby's born. But if you do so 5 minutes later, then all of a sudden you turn out to be a criminal. I'm trying to explain that. At any rate, now I turn to the very core of my topic. All of us experience defeat. Many of us experience many defeats. Many of us can peacefully say at the end of our life, I have achieved very little. You know, you haven't been particularly talented or parallel this and this and this, and you say, I have not succeeded. But if you accept your defeat with humility, and you say to God, give me the grace to understand that you have permitted this defeat so that I learn the most precious of all things, humility, you are achieving an incredible victory. This is precisely what I'm going to try to show to you by means of very concrete examples. You know, the world in which we live, and not only the business world, I can speak about university professors, and I'm truly a veteran because I spent my life seeing the rivalry and the bickering between professors to claim that they're greater or more intelligent or publish more and they should be promoted, not the other one. Don't you believe that the university world is any bit better than Wall Street? The difference is that in Wall Street, everyone in has a dagger and shows it, whereas in university, it is done underground, but it is basically the same principle. Now, suppose that we turn to the business world. It is based on competition. You have one company and there's another company, and what you have to do is to convince people that your company is better and cheaper and so on and so on, and then you defeat the other one. And if the other one is bankrupt, then you achieve a fantastic victory and you're promoted. The word rivalry should not exist in Catholic life. You start a Catholic organization in defense of life. You start another one in defense of life, and all of a sudden you find out that there's rivalry between them. And people are going to say, well, man is much better. You have to promote man because the other one is no good. Every work which glorifies God should be welcome, whether I play a part in it or not. There's only one rivalry which should be acclaimed in the Roman Catholic Church, and then there's much too little of it. It is a holy rivalry. And what do I mean by holy rivalry? To compete with one another in a spirit of charity or humility or willingness to help others or to sacrifice oneself for others. I'm a Benedictine oblate, and in his holy rule, St. Benedict says, quotes, let the monks vow in paying obedience to one another. There we should be rival. Who is going to be more obedient? Who is going to be the servant? In the world, you say, I'm the master, and you are the servant. And in Catholic's life, if you truly live it, you say, it's a grace for me to serve you. This is what we should. Life is full of hurdles and pains. But he alone who, through God's grace, has adopted a supernatural posture will experience, after long, painful struggles and many defeats, that every single suffering, every single defeat can be changed into a victory for God. Let me give you concrete examples. Suppose, for example, that you have a physical appearance which doesn't make you very happy. And this is true for very many good people, because, I mean, after all, when he gave me my face, he didn't say, darling, which face would you like to have? But it was a choice that he made for me, and it is just as well to accept it and simply say, my dear God, your taste might not be my taste, but, I mean, you are the master, and I'm just going to put up with it. Now, in the world in which we live, you're given a particular face, and then the New York Times is going to tell you that if you buy refined cosmetics, which cost a fortune, you're going to become a beauty. And I know that there are young girls, and not only young girls, but women who spend fortunes on cosmetics. You find out that one little piece like this can cost you $100, but it promises that it's going to make an overwhelming beauty out of you. So the number of women who spend hours trying to improve, spend an enormous amount of money, spend their time improving themselves or believing that they improve themselves, because sometimes you play roulette and you make yourself worse than God has made you. That can also happen. You know, it's a risk that you have to face. It's always a possibility. Now, suppose that you take a supernatural attitude. I cannot change my face radically. The only thing is that I have to try to make the best of what I've been, because there's no sense in making oneself uglier than necessary. That's not also, it's not a divine command, trying to make yourself as ugly as possible. No, just try to make the best of what you have. But suppose that you take a supernatural attitude and you say to yourself, do you realize that if you are not responsible for the face that you are born with, you're responsible for the face you're going to have in eternity. Do you realize that there's something, this is a new invention of mine, I don't know whether I like it, but nevertheless, holy cosmetics. And I mean by holy cosmetics that every act of love, of patience, of humility, of service, of generosity, chisel the face that I'm going to have in eternity. And eternity, we might find out that some people that were deplorably ugly turn out to be overwhelming beauty. And I'm not sure that Cleopatra, who is supposed to have the finest nose that ever was produced, is doing so well on the other side. Keep this in mind. This is something that we can do. And I can promise success. Whereas if you spend your fortune on cosmetics, I do not promise at all that because you change the color of your hair, or because you change this or that feature, you have aesthetic surgery or anesthetic surgery. This is going to change you radically. This is something that you can do. Suppose that you are born with very bad eyesight. And people who are born with very bad eyesight suffer because already in school other children are going to make fun. What? You can't see that? Children are cruel because of original sin. No, suppose that nothing can be done. I have a bad eyesight. And then I can go on my knees and say, my God, give me sharp eyes so that I truly see what you expect me to do. And then you will find out that in eternity you have the eyes of an eagle. And then to quote the Psalms, there are people who have eyes and do not see. They have ears and do not hear. And this is the case of innumerable famous people. They have eyes and do not see. Do you think that some people see that abortion is wrong? No! They are blind. And blindness is often a punishment for sin. Suppose that you are born with a very bad hearing, which once again is going to make your life unbelievably difficult moment after moment. Well, it cannot be changed. You try some sort of gadget, it doesn't work. And you say to God, give me a hearing which is so refined that I hear every whisper of your will. Then you turn out to have remarkable ears here, whereas most people are deaf, absolutely deaf. They don't hear. Suppose that you don't have a high IQ. Mother Angelica always brags that her IQ was 90. When for someone who was at 90, she didn't do that badly, but she always says, oh, no, my IQ was 90. She wasn't doing well in school and for very good reasons. Now, suppose that people say, you are not talented, you know, don't try it, you know, don't try for goodness sake. I mean, just realize that you are very, very limited. But you see, suppose that I had 10 doctorates and I go to God and I say, look, these are all my doctorates I have in philology and I have in philosophy and I have it in history and I have in music and so on and so on. And it doesn't do any good in heaven. The only thing that matters is, do you have humility? Do you lovingly accepted my word and understood it and put it in practice? You know, Saint Teresa of Lisieux was no genius. She left school when she was 15. She probably was fairly ignorant, you know, taking to the high standard that we have today. And she's a doctor of the church. And I'm not certain that certain people down at Notre Dame are going to make it. You know, one never knows, but it's not my suspicion. Their chances are very, very small. And St. Teresa of Lisieux did it. Suppose that you are betrayed. You had a close friend and full of admiration for this friend, and this friend betrays you. And then, as we did last week, look at the way that Christ greeted Judas, who betrayed him. He says, friend, for what purpose hast thou come? No insult, no word of friend, one who has betrayed him. This is supernatural, and now they tell you something about the supernatural. Don't try to do it on your own. You can't. Our human nature, our fallen human nature, bristle at that sort of things. But say to God, I cannot do it, but you are all powerful, and you can give it to me. You cannot do it on your own. Worse, suppose now that we are treated with abominable injustice. Now, once again, let me read a part of the Holy Rule of Saint Benedict. He says to his monks, quote, the fourth degree of humility is that meeting in this obedience with difficulties, contradictions, and even injustices, you should with a quiet mind hold fast with patience, enduring, and neither tire nor run away. Injustices. And you don't defend yourself, you accept it. And why do you accept it? Because was Christ treated justly? He, the man of sorrow, he, the Holy One, a man of sorrow, rejected, spat upon, ridiculed, flouted, crucified. And I say, but I should be well treated. Don't you dare treat me badly. Then you have forgotten what is the message of the gospel. St. Francis of Assisi teaches us that when his father rejected him, you know, he was just spending his father's money giving to the poor, and his father got mad and threw him out. And then he went to the piazza in Assisi stripped himself of his clothing, which his father had given him, and said, from now on, I say, my Father in heaven. So you are rejected by your father, but you have a Father in heaven. You are rejected by your mother, but there is a Holy Virgin opening her arms to you. St. Francis goes so far as to say that is what is perfect joy. You come to a monastery late at night and you bang on the door and you are drenched, has been raining, it's cold. And for some reason the porter says to you, you are thieves and liars. And you say, no, no, we belong to the, no, no. And he comes and beats them and throws them in the snow. And he says, this is perfect joy. Is he mad? Well, naturally speaking, of course he's raving mad, but he's taken by holy madness, the desire to follow Christ, when things that are bitter become sweet. St. Ignatius of Loyola, from the moment of his conversion, devoted his whole life to the building of the Jesuit order. And he wrote in his life that if the whole work would collapse, you know, be destroyed for some reason, it would not take him more than 15 minutes in front of the Blessed Sacrament to regain his peace. One of the greatest sources of suffering. And now I come to the very heart. My whole topic was leading here because it's very actual. When the church lets us down, and when I say church, I don't mean the holy bride of Christ. I mean the church with a small c, lowercase c, which means members of the church. Recently, I reread a superb little book called La Passion de la Iglesia by a Spanish monk, in which he's speaking about the situation in the church today and comparing it to what happened at the time of the crucifixion. On the one hand, you have Christ, the Son of God, now symbolized, replaced, incarnated in the Holy Catholic Church without wrinkles and without blemish. And then you have the members of the church, the apostles, replaced by high dignitaries in the church and by priests or nuns. What happens when Christ is arrested? One of his disciples betrays him, another one denies him, and all of them fled. What heroes? No, he says, this seems to be happening. The church has to go through the same crucifixion that in the time of her greatest needs, because the church is going to probably the most severe crisis in her history. She seems to be betrayed by people who are supposed to defend her. This is what we are facing today. And what is the answer? God always wins, because in spite of this dreadful, abominable defeat, the apostles come back. All of them became martyrs. Judas took his own life. All of them became martyrs and died, happy to suffer with Christ. And after Golgotha comes the resurrection. In the 18th century, the Jesuits started a remarkable mission in Paraguay with the Indians. With incredible difficulties and suffering, they started to build up Catholicism in Paraguay because of political pressure. One very fine day, they got the order to close the whole thing down. Not a word of bitterness. They obeyed, and the thing was destroyed. In the 18th century, in 1773, the Jesuit order, founded by St. Ignatius 2.5 centuries earlier, was terminated, downfall, by Pope Clement XIV under the pressure of the Freemasons, particularly the Freemasons of Portugal, one of them called Pombal, who hated the Jesuits. What happened to the Jesuits? No country in Western Europe will accept them. They were thrown out, they were on a ship, they had no food, they had no medicine. Hundreds of them died. And finally, they receive hospitality, believe it or not, in Russia and Germany, inviting them because of the extraordinary educational talents. Not a word of complaint they suffered. Just imagine what the church in China is suffering. And sometimes you expect to get more support and more help. When St. Teresa of Avila started to reform her order, she was criticized, she was slandered, she was ridiculed. And she writes in her autobiography, all the things that people say about me are much too kind. If they only knew what a sinner I was, they would consider that their judgment is very gentle. During her novitiate, St. Teresa of Lisieux was constantly humiliated and criticized for things that she had not done. Read her autobiography. Did she revolt? No. She guessed the grant and asked for forgiveness. Padre Pio, who is going to be canonized very soon, was under a cloud for years. He was not permitted to say Mass in public. You can be convinced that this very holy man quoted Psalm 118. It is good for me that you have humbled me so that I may learn your statutes. That is Psalm 118. How many of us know it? How many of us pray it? What about the holy Cardinal Mitzenti, the primate of Hungary, imprisoned by the communists for 8 years? Hidden in the American embassy in Budapest for 15 years. And then, under the pressure of Casaroli, Pope Pius VI told him to come back to Rome. And he begged the Pope not to do it. He said, I want to stay with my people. I'm primate of Hungary. He was ordered to come back. And he was told that he was going to remain primate of Hungary for his life. He arrived in Rome. The Pope embraced him very lovingly, sent him to Vienna, and a couple of months later he gets a letter saying that he has been replaced by another primate more acceptable to the communist government. There was a tempest among Roman Catholics, inundating the famous Bacon priest. He received thousands of letters of protest saying, this is shameful. And then this very holy priest wrote the following letter, and I copied it for your sake. You might not know it. He said, you, your eminence, were led among the way of the cross, such as hardly any cardinal had to tread. God considered you mature enough to bear what would to exceed everything that had gone before. You were to bear the cross of disciplinary measures and start as one whose obstinacy had to be broken. That you did not fall to the temptation of justifying yourself publicly, but accepted rather the cross came from where you had least expected it. It's when the eyes of faith, the crown of your great life. And today, I'm not going to go into detail, I'm going to discreetly limit myself to hints, but you're so sharp that you're going to get them. Suppose that you devote your whole life to a pro-life movement, highly successful, and all of a sudden, you're severely penalized. Now, of course, the human response to that, at least on my part, is resentment and bitterness. What is a supernatural answer? God does not need me. Even if I do my very best, I am, to quote St. Luke, a useless servant. May his will be done. He can achieve what he wants to without me. What about a very holy pastor who draws hundreds and hundreds of parishioners whose parish is full to capacity? And even though he's still very healthy, is forced to retire. What is a human response? Rage, anger, bitterness. How dare you? And then what happens, supernaturally speaking, you say, God, who can draw good out of evil, accept the humble suffering of this great man. Maybe this is what he still needs in order to achieve holiness. And in your own way, you will make up for the evil which seems to be done. What about someone who starts a remarkable Catholic publishing house and a remarkable educator, and all of a sudden you find out, end of it. The response is rage. That is a human response. What is a supernatural response? My beloved Savior, you know what you permit. I didn't say will, you say permit. Draw good out of evil and use me in some other fashion so that in any case I can glorify you. That is supernatural. And then you have peace, and then simultaneously you actually do more for the church than by fighting a hopeless fight. And I say hopeless because a superior is a superior. And I mean, you cannot simply, the very moment that you break your vow of obedience, you find yourself in a very, very shaky situation. Now I'm going to share, end my talk with a very, very personal remark. I come from a Catholic family. I was a cradle Catholic. I had the blessing of having an extraordinary pious father, a daily communicant, a man of incredible purity, integrity, and goodness. But when I was 5, I received 2 extraordinary graces. I had some sort of an inkling at that time they were graces, but I mean, in the course of my life, I understood how extraordinary they were. I entered school when I was 5, and very soon the nuns started to prepare us for First Communion. And then I became deadly ill. I had a double pneumonia at a time when there were no myosin and no penicillin, and I was very, very close to death. And I recall so clearly that I was so weak that I would not even open my eyes. And my mother was on the side of my little white wooden bed and leaned over me and said to me, "Oh, darling, if you only knew how I wish to suffer this for you." At 5, I said to myself, "Don't you ever forget this. This is true love." Then I recovered, as you see. It's no miracle because you see me talking to you. And my communion was postponed for quite a while because the preparation was very long and I missed the date. And then one day the nun came into the classroom with a little bulletin, you know, cheap looking little piece of paper. And she said, "Children, I just got this from a parish in Paris." You know, Brussels and Paris are very close. And she said, "It is from the slums of Paris." And it relates that the priest was teaching these little slum French children about the crucifixion of Christ, betrayed by Judas, and then Judas hanged himself on a tree, and Christ was killed. And the children were horrified. There was a deadly silence in the room, not a sound. And then a little fellow who had received the grace of baptism raised his hand and said, "Father, why didn't Judas hang himself on the neck of Christ?" I was overwhelmed. And at 5, I understood that in life, we are all failures. The saints alone are not failures. All of us are failures. But may we, at the moment of death, hang ourselves on Christ's neck. Thank you.
If you wish to ask questions of Dr. von Hildebrandt, please raise your hand and we'll take them as one by one as we.
The new book is just on sale on the table there afterwards.
We have this gentleman down here. And repeat the question if you would, please.
You speak well of submission.
You know, I speak about submission, and the gentleman raises the question whether there are cases in which we have to act or do something. Well, it all depends what the order is. You know, if it is something which is immoral, you have no problem at all, because we must obey God rather than men. And if a superior orders you to do something which is in any way immoral, then obviously you'll have to say no, and that's all. It's not a disobedience. If it's a formal question of saying, you know, you go from this place and this other place, then it seems to me that submission is very, very highly valued by God. I do believe there are cases in which it's necessary to try to do something about it. But if you are defeated, accept a defeat defeat in the spirit of faith. Now, in such cases, I know people who find themselves in a dreadfully difficult situation because they question the sincerity or the person giving this order. I mean, sometimes there's a great deal of malice in it. In this case, it's always advisable to have a spiritual director and pray God to send you someone who's going to help you. Because there's such a thing as conscience. And of course, if my conscience is illumined by grace and my conscience is not pursuing my own interests, then it is legitimate to follow one's conscience. But I don't think that I have the wisdom to give you concrete advice in a particular situation, that you have to turn to people that are truly experts in this domain. But it's an extremely sensitive domain, very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you very much.